Today on Speaking Out of Place, we have a special extended conversation on the suppression of Palestine solidarity at universities from the US to the UK to within Israel itself. We are grateful to be joined by Adi Mansour, a lawyer with Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, Neve Gordon, Professor of Human Rights Law at Queen Mary University of London and Vice President of the British Society for Middle East Studies, and Laurie Brand, former president of the Middle East Studies Association of North America and current chair of its Committee on Freedom of Expression. We had been planning this episode for many months with the ever-intensifying climate of repression, but the immediate impetus was the suspension of eminent feminist scholar Dr. Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem for comments she had made regarding Hamas's October 7th attacks and the genocide in Gaza. And so, Adi, perhaps you could begin by laying out the details for us of Nadra's case.
The case of Professor Nadra is actually quite interesting. It started out with her participating in a podcast, and then a lot of fake news basically about what was within the podcast itself, and a lot of incitement and actually campaign, a whole campaign against Nadra, describing her as someone who actually says that there was no sexual violence during the 7th of October, that there were certain crimes that were not committed, even though she didn't say any of that topics. But eventually, what we've seen with the case going forward is the fact that the university itself was upset with Nadra even before any of this happened. After this started, the university issued a statement that they decided to temporarily suspend Nadra from the university, specifically from teaching, which caused a huge stir. There were also protests within the Hebrew University. And through the statement, and also from other statements that were published afterwards, we discovered that what was very upsetting for the university is the fact that it describes itself as a Zionist university, and that Nadra has continuously challenged this with different writing on the colonialist structure of Israel, and also about the unchilding of Palestinians and different subjects deriving from criminology and the oppressive state, specifically within East Jerusalem. And suddenly we see that the whole discussion about Nadra is the fact that she is anti-Israeli or anti-Zionist, the fact that she's describing Israel as a criminal state and describing what is happening as a genocide. What's also crazy about this is that Nadra traveled for a conference. Once she arrived back, she was called by the police for an investigation. Initially, she was released, but a couple of days afterwards, the police declared that they went to the state prosecutor and asked for an approval to investigate with Nadra Shalhoub for speech offenses and for supporting and sympathizing with terrorist organization. And here you see a case where the general public opinion and the campaigns that are run by students and also academics, in a lot of cases, eventually influence the institution itself, which only needed this general atmosphere in order to conduct this act against Nadra or any other lecturer within the university. And you see how much the complicity eventually between institutions and the police and between the state attorney. And Nadra is not the first case where it starts with a disciplinary procedure and continues to a criminal investigation. We have cases of students that the university decided to go and file a complaint to the police in parallel to a disciplinary procedure and disciplinary measure, despite the fact that a lot of these institutions love to describe themselves as understanding and progressive. For example, Tel Aviv University, where they talk a lot about pluralism. And if you study political science or social sciences or law, there's a lot of emphasis where they talk about the conditions of Palestinian citizens of Israel. But suddenly, they are not sensitive at all in order to file a complaint to the police. And everybody knows what that complaint could lead to. Eventually, a lot of students were arrested, interrogated, harassed in prison because of the universities that filed the complaint against them. Therefore, if we look at the case of Nadra, which has caused really a stir outside of, at least outside of the Israeli academia, but there are a lot of voices within the Israeli academia supporting Nadra, is that, and this is, I think, very similar to the IHRA in that sense, that anybody who in any way questions anything that has to do with the state's propaganda towards what is happening during the war, any criticism of what is going on, any attempt for fact-checking even, is considered as that you are actually like you are going against the state, but you are also not willing to admit the atrocities that have happened. And a lot of cases, also Nadra that said, no, I'm not saying that war crimes were not committed on the 7th of October. We had also cases of other students who were coming in front of disciplinary committees who said, no, I'm not saying that war crimes did not happen. But we are questioning things that have come to the media. For example, we had the case of the 40 beheaded babies that have come to the news and a lot of instances. And there was a student actually in Ben-Gurion University that was eventually not only accused and charged, and eventually she was found guilty of supporting terrorism because she posted a video where the main issue is that cases like that eventually lead to atrocities, propaganda, which lead eventually to the justification of killing of more people, which eventually we saw. So yeah, when we're talking about the IHRA or any kind of limits to the free speech in that sense within academia, it's understanding that these academic institutions have decided upon themselves what is permissible and what is not to be discussed in the first hand. And this eventually leads to very huge limits on academic freedom and the ability to write and to analyze or to criticize. And in a very absurd way, at the same time that there is a genocide that is happening where the actual conclusions that derive from the Holocaust and from other cases of genocide and mass killings and atrocities that we have faced worldwide are actually necessary in the critical understanding and in the analyzing of what we are witnessing today in Gaza.
I'm hopeful that the fact that her case was fought so vociferously by international civil society and yielded some result that was positive may be also a tipping point.
Can I say something about Nadira's case?
Sure. Yeah,
one
absolutely.
More thing.
Yeah, and then I'd like to after Niamh.
The letter, they sent a few letters. They began with her signing a petition in the beginning of the war against the killing of children. And then they immediately sent their letters to social media and the media. And we need to understand that in the atmosphere within Israel, it's almost an incitement to violence, what these presidents and rector provosts of the universities did. Within that atmosphere, to blame, again, as Adi said, some of it is really fake news, but to blame Nadira within this atmosphere, it becomes a real danger for her. Not only that, she lives in the old city. It becomes a danger there, not only on campus. It's really irresponsible and very dangerous what they did. Now, I was with Nadira the day after this last event happened. And I have to say, all she was concerned about, she's a very courageous woman, and all she was concerned about was the students that were supporting her, that they won't be targeted, okay? Because she was afraid that any sign of support from students would lead to the targeting of those students. So that's the kind of atmosphere we need to understand. We need to understand, I know of two Palestinian professors that were fired from their colleges. They're not big names like Nadira. It's this part is also part of it that they go under the radar and just they lost their jobs for free. So this whole world is, again, it's changing how we see things.
I had just one question again about Nadira's case. We, at CAF, we took up both the case in the fall and then this more recent one. I was struck, and Adi, correct me if I'm wrong, the initial letter from the Hebrew University president and provost in this second episode focused on her having criticized Israel as a Zionist state. And those seem to me to be the elements that they argued led to their decision to suspend her. Then when one sees the statement that she attached her name to, which was translated into, I saw it in English and Arabic and Hebrew, that focused on her having recanted, in if that's the right word, what she had to say about the atrocities of the 7th of October. And I've been very interested in the way that the 7th of October narrative has changed, the evidence, the alternative media reporting on it, and so on. And also the particular timing of the weaponization of particularly the rape charges. I was struck by the fact that it seemed to me there was a disconnect between what the president had accused her of in the initial letter of suspension and what she said, which they accepted as grounds for her reinstatement. I don't know if this is all something that you want to include in the podcast or not, but I'm just curious, Adi, am I wrong or any thoughts about that you could share?
And Niamh, correct me if I get something wrong, but as far as I remember, it started like this and it up like that. It started with that she's going against the state, but she's also going against the narrative of the 7th of October and et cetera, et cetera. And then they started dealing with the backlash, yeah? So it narrowed down to much less issues. So they changed that and they changed their approach. They changed their statement. And as far as I know, I don't think Nader actually did what they said that she did, right, Niamh?
So basically, they started, like you said, Laurie, with it's not Zionist, but also with the reconstruction of October 7th. Then there was a backlash on the Zionism. And there were people that resigned from their positions, administrative positions, as heads of departments and things like that at Hebrew University, saying, you don't have to be a Zionist to work in a university, as from Universal. And so then it went to the October 7th. And what Nadira, if I understood her, said is that we, not that we don't have evidence of rape, we don't have evidence of mass rape. Okay. And that's arguable. I'm not saying she's right. I'm just saying it is arguable. And then they called her in for a meeting and they said that she recanted. She said she clarified. I don't think there was no public apology, no public recantation on her part. And so it's the reason, I think Adi's absolutely correct. The reason they narrowed down is they understood that their Zionism argument is problematic even within the university. And then it became that. And so you see, I follow some of it on social media. You see how liberal Zionists in the law school and in the social work school immediately said, no, she can be a non-Zionist, particularly because she's Palestinian, right? But then they went after her on that specific thing about the rape. And I was in a talk with her again. It was a day or two later, and it was very clear in the talk also that she was critical of the discourse of mass rapes and not of rapes.
And very important on this topic is that none of these statements were made anywhere near the Hebrew University. Mm. She is being accused by the university on things she is doing during her life as an academic or as a universal academic, as an international academic whatsoever. The fact that for years Nader has been teaching and other people have been teaching about or from anti-colonial aspects, analyzing the situation and the unchilding and etc. All this when that was during academia and during teaching. But suddenly, and as Niamh mentioned, when suddenly we're talking about anything that has to do with outside the state or the mainstream analysis of what's happening, even when we're talking about understandings deriving from an academic point of view, suddenly the university cannot absorb this academic person within the university, not for being what she did in the university itself. And that is to talk about how many professors in Israeli institutions who have wild opinions, to say the least, on different topics and on different matter, just lets you understand that eventually we're talking about the academia, as I've mentioned before, how it perceives itself as an Israeli institution, even though they eventually dismissed that. But it's how they perceive themselves and how they perceive anyone who is belonging to them as having to be part of the identity that eventually, after the 7th of October, they had to reinstate or in different cases had to establish it as the identity of that academic institution.
Thank you.
And also, just to point out for listeners that these accusations against Professor Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian also come in a context of mass intensified sexual violence and femicide against Palestinian women, which is instantly denied and erased. And so again, this is yet another example of these types of inversions that we see of the discourse of we believe survivors being deployed against a scholar who has done so much to reveal the context of necropolitical and settler colonial violence against Palestinian women.
So here are my questions that I'm going to pose to each of you, just meant to give a sense of the dimensions of the issue we're talking about today. First, Niamh, you've spoken often about how the war in Gaza has had a particularly chilling effect on universities in the UK and US, where certain freedoms are not only supposed to apply, but are supposed to apply for reasons that lie at the core of the missions of universities. That is, the mandate to seek and debate knowledge. There are probably a few other areas that are hard to discuss. Can you tell us what is specific about the chilling speech about Palestine? And then second, for Adi, you've written about how this issue has specific valence in Israeli universities. Can you first tell us a little bit about the unique nature of Israeli universities? And I'm thinking of Maya Wynn's recent book, for example, and then the exceptional measures being used to silence and punish speech there, not just on Gaza, but other areas as well of public life. And I read one of your interviews and you said you compared it almost to military rules. So I'd like you to flesh that out a bit for us. And finally, Laurie, the board of directors of the Middle East Studies Association and its Committee on Academic Freedom issued a very robust condemnation of the war in Palestine from a number of angles. And MESA has for many years discussed the topic of academic freedom in Palestine. Could you tell us briefly about previous discussions you have had and then explain what drove MESA to this particular statement? It's a very capacious and moving and robust document, and I especially appreciated the connection to the Genocide Convention. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that. So perhaps, Niamh, if you could start.
So yes, so first, thank you for inviting me. I think the US and the UK are actually very different. So I'd prefer if Laurie talked about the US because of two things. One is the donor culture, which we really do not have in the UK, and that has become an important aspect of the clampdown on academic freedom in the US, including the firing of two presidents of Ivy League universities. And two, that actually the right to freedom of speech is much more protected in the US than it is in the UK setting. So that cocktail in the US is a bit different than the UK. What we have seen is unprecedented. I think Laurie called it in another panel we were on a McCarthyite moment, where basically Israel is carrying out a genocidal war in the Gaza Strip, where hundreds of people are dying every day, and now we are on the abyss of a famine. And yet the universities in the UK are clamping down on freedom of speech and trying to silence Palestinian and pro-Palestinian voices. I'll explain a bit how it happens in the UK. So first, it's multi-layered. And second, it's capillary. Multi-layered in the sense that there's these innocuous kind of meetings where a head of department will call someone in and will tell them, hey, maybe you don't need to speak up so much about Palestine. It's very sensitive now and management are a bit clamping down in a kind of friendly way, silencing the departmental member. Then we have incidents of telling people to take off posters from their doors or from adding a speaker to balance something out. And then we have the cancellation of events because it's too sensitive or we cannot secure the safety of the speakers or the audience. Then we have students who want to stage a protest, and the protest is for ceasefire. It's an anti-violence protest, and they're being told it's unsafe or you didn't file the request in time or different kind of bureaucratic mechanisms to silence them. Then we have the professors that teach human rights and come to the head of their school and tell them, listen, I'm planning to teach an Israel-Palestine course next semester with a focus on human rights, and I want to teach the Human Rights Watch report or the Amnesty International report on apartheid. But the university has signed the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, and one of the illustrative examples is that you can't say that Israel's a racist endeavor. So if I teach these human rights texts and someone complains that I violated the IHRA definition, will you protect me? And the heads of the school say, no, because the university signed the IHRA, we cannot protect you. So the course is canceled. And then we have more serious impact in the sense that people that are suspended from universities, we have arrests of numerous students, and here the suspensions, the investigations, the disciplinary hearings, and the arrest in the EU primarily target women of color. The way the apparatus works is that their social media is mined often, sometimes going back years to when they were teenagers, okay? It's mined. And then either it's mined by the Jewish Chronicle or by the Telegraph or by some kind of right-wing outlet, or someone mines it and gives it to the university. These newspapers request from the universities a response. And as part of this cycle, the university opens an investigation, and there we begin the kind of via della rosa that these people are dragged through investigations, disciplinary hearings, suspensions. Now, there's a group that was created about 4 years ago called the European Legal Support Center. It's the sister organization of Palestine Legal. And it represents people that are silenced on Palestine in Holland, in Germany, and in the UK. ELSC, the European Legal Support Center, would get an average of 100 complaints a year from all three countries put together. In the first month after October 7th, they received 100 complaints. In the past half year, in England only, there's been 250 complaints that have come to them, namely people, 250 people, students, staff, and other people who have been targeted for supposedly hate speech or supporting terror speech by their employer, by a newspaper, and so forth. So we have this major clampdown that is on all levels. Indeed, in my own university, the management broke into the union officers in order to take down from the window posters of a Palestinian flag that says ceasefire on it. And so this is major stuff, and we haven't seen a lot of that, and a lot of people are under stress. A lot of people, this will have an impact on their lives for years because they've been cast and branded as anti-Semitic or as supporting terrorism, and it's a major moment. So this is the kind of overview picture of the UK.
There are many parallels, lots of similarities between what Niamh has described as happening in the UK and what's been happening in the United States. I know legally he's correct that there's greater freedom of expression, First Amendment rights in the US, and they affect or applied in different ways depending on when we talk about the university level, depending on what state one is in. And that's one of the complicating factors in trying to generalize about the United States, which, because we have individual states, we have state institutions, we've got the private institutions, and state laws vary in terms of the degree to which they protect freedom of expression on campus. In some cases, students, we have in California here the Leonard Law, which I believe protects students' First Amendment rights on campus, but professors don't have quite the same protections. So it's a very complicated picture. But having said that, I think in general, the types of violations that Niamh noted are the kinds of things we see in the States, everything from what I would call lower level forms of harassment and intimidation, which often take place on social media. I'm not sure that I would refer to doxing as lower level intimidation, however, because that also can have its effects that can be long lasting. various attempts by universities to shut down programs to prevent their being authorized in the first place. We see all kinds of scrambling among universities whereby existing university handbook procedures and regulations are either not applied as they should have been, or there are new ones that are come up with after the fact and sometimes then are applied retroactively to events and to speech, which is dreadful. There are also what I would call the battle of the statements at the very beginning of the war, or maybe battle is not the right way to refer to it, because basically we had a beginning of a trend of university presidents issuing statements about the war. And some of them, at least initially, were addressed sort of both sides, expressing concern primarily about the university community and the repercussions that was happening in Israel-Palestine on members of those communities in their own institutions, as well as people who had extended family and other ties. But in some cases, certainly in the case of my university and others, there were then subsequent statements that updated the initial ones. And these came as the result, we know, of pressures from outside. And the second wave of statements was much less balanced. It's not a word I like, but there tended to be much more of a focus on concerns about anti-Semitism on campus, about the concerns of Jewish or pro-Israel students, about the murder of Israelis on the 7th of October, but very little, if any, discussion of what happened subsequently in Gaza. And then as time passed and some of these statements became somewhat problematic, it seems that universities decided we just aren't going to issue statements anymore. As this has unfolded and become clear that this genocidal violence, which is being visited on the Palestinians of Gaza, universities have simply largely been silent. One of the messages that comes through to faculty and students who are in the Palestine solidarity community in general, regardless of what political, ethnic, religious background happens to be, is that university administrators are not on your side. University administrators are people to whom you probably can't go, who probably won't protect you, even though you hear from the other side of administrators' mouths. On the one hand, they're saying anti-Semitism is a central problem on this campus. On the other hand, they're saying, oh, but everybody should feel free to come and report their concerns to Title VI, which deals with discrimination on basis of national origin and intrinsic categories. And yet we see differential forms of investigation of complaints that are brought to these various offices. So the overall sentiment is one where the administration is not the people to whom one can go and hope to receive any kind of relief or serious concern or sympathy. And so I think a lot of students and faculty have felt that they need to go to each other. And so I think we've seen a much greater development of solidarity among faculty on the basis of the politics of what's happening now. And then also trying to come up with new initiatives, some of which are very informal, to try and help students, whether it's mentoring, whether it's providing them a safe space to discuss what's going on. So those are the things that I see happening in the U.S. And there are, you know, trends, pre-existing trends that have brought us to this point, one of which was the general atmosphere in the U.S. before this war began, which is where the Israel-Palestine issue has always been contentious, and where those who were in the Palestine Solidarity Committee or community were generally the ones who were under siege or the ones who had fewer rights or whose rights were more likely to be violated. So the epicenter of the contestation over Palestinian rights has really become the university campus in the United States.
Thank you. Adi.
Yeah. Thank you, first of all. It's maybe to understand the nature of Israeli universities, which is a bit different from talking about UK and US universities, that we're talking about universities that are part of the Israeli society, but they are also part of the Israeli system that is, in fact, the one that is manifesting the genocide in Gaza. And now we're talking 6 months into this war that has caused the loss of more than 30,000 people. Since the 7th of October is an attempt to frame the Israeli universities as spaces that define their identity, but also demand from the students to align with the identity of the university itself, but more than that, the identity and the ideology of the state within the state of war. And this is where it gets interesting, because what we've been dealing with in Adala and generally after the 7th of October is a crackdown on free speech, but more than that, is a crackdown on Palestinians for being Palestinians. And Neil mentioned a McCarthyan moment in that sense. And I think that what we felt really is that you are basically under a trial until you prove otherwise. You are guilty until you prove otherwise, generally speaking, even before anything happens. In order to discuss what happened in Israeli universities, it's important to understand we're talking about a general crackdown on Palestinians, where there was a prevention of protests altogether against the war. Any kind of protest supporting Gaza or criticizing Israel on the war. The police commander issued a statement where he said anyone who wants to protest the war is invited to take a bus to Gaza. And there have been attempts to protest. And eventually, in the last month, month and a half, there were actual protests. But during most of this time, any attempt to protest ended with arrests and even with criminal charges of slogans that have been chanted by Palestinians for the last 40, 50 years or so. And as David mentioned, one of our main arguments in that sense is that we are talking about a situation that is very much similar to a military rule. Now, the similarity to a military rule, which is a bit different in that sense, is that in a military rule where you suspend the rule of law and you act upon emergency regulations, specifically when we're talking about political participation, the Israeli legal system has reached a point where the Israeli law itself is enough in order to act in an emergency-like situation and to oppress Palestinians based on the civil law or the penal code itself. And therefore, what we've witnessed is that since the 7th of October, we're talking about more than 400 arrests on free speech on social media and more than 120 criminal charges against persons for posting on social media. Now, this number is around 5 years compared to previous parts or before the 7th of October. And maybe just to give a bit of numbers, so between 2018 to 2021, for example, we were talking about 50 criminal charges in 3 years. Now we're talking about almost more than double than that in a couple of months. Therefore, there was a general attempt to silence Palestinians and to prevent any kind of expression, with increased monitoring of any activity on social media, increased prevention of any attempt for political participation or any kind of association or any kind of mobilization, honestly, and leading to a situation where Palestinians, citizens of Israel, are living in a state of fear of being arrested and of being investigated. Now, this comes with horrific and terrifying stories of people who got arrested, and some of which are still in prison, of course. So we're talking about political prison, either on free speech, but also thousands of people who got arrested from the West Bank and Gaza. And the testimonies that we are hearing from the prisons are terrifying, are Guantanamo-like situations where people are being starved and are being harassed and attacked continuously. There are some stories where they have to hear the Israeli national anthem all night until the morning, and different aspects of these very extreme and radical means of oppression that even when we're talking about the situation of political prisoners previously, now we're talking about a situation that is even much worse. Now, in parallel, academic institutions, both universities and colleges, decided to start acting in... There is no less way to say it than a sub-state actor when it comes to freedom of expression on social media. In that sense, which is different from the UK and the US, is that the academic institutions decided to go outside of, to start disciplinary measures outside of campus. Now, remember, we're talking about October, November, December. There weren't any school back then. The physical campuses were closed, at least. And more than 150 students face disciplinary measures for posts on social media that have no connection whatsoever to their studies within the university or within the college. Now, apart from the fact that this goes against the Israeli law that basically describes in the Student Rights Law, Article 17, the limits of which an academic institution is allowed to prevent or to act upon their disciplinary measures against a student, which have to be in connection to their studies themselves. But it also means a lot that these universities and institutions have perceived themselves as having authority despite lacking authority. There's a very famous case in the Israeli Supreme Court called Yardur. And that case, which discusses also the case of the Al-Ard party, which was a Palestinian party during, I think, the early 60s, which were running for parliament, and they were prevented despite the fact that there was no law to prevent them from running to parliament. And the rationale behind that is that this party poses a threat to society itself. And therefore, even if there is no authority that allows us to prevent this party, we as a state have authority to prevent something that poses a threat to our mere existence, which of course wasn't the case. Now, it's interesting that the same terminology, the same rationale is used by academic institutions against Palestinian students for mere posts and stories on Instagram. And actually, this argument about Yardur was made by a university, a leading university in Israel, claiming authority outside of the authority. Yes, maybe we don't have authority according to the law, but we are acting against the rule of law because we institutions are under a threat of existence as part of the threat of existence of the 7th of October, meaning that the Palestinian students were perceived as the enemy from within, equal to the events of the 7th of October, and therefore perceived as a threat to the existence and to the remaining of the universities and the colleges. And this is why we see that these disciplinary measures, in their essence, they are a test of loyalty. In their essence, they are a test of either you're with us, not only as an Israeli, but also as someone during this war, where you have to prove that you are supporting the state, that you are supporting the means of the war itself, but most importantly, that you are not the enemy. But you are perceived as the enemy because you are Palestinian. And this is where any kind of legal protection, any kind of protection in due process, any kind of protection where, for example, the prosecutor have to prove their case, what we've witnessed generally is the opposite. The student has to prove that he does not support terrorism. We had a crazy case in an institution where a student posted a quote from the Quran. And the argument of the prosecution in that institution, they said that there are leaders in Hamas who used the same quote from the Quran. And they brought even an expert opinion from a professor in Orientalism in Tel Aviv University, who wrote that there is no doubt whoever uses this quote that he supports Hamas because Hamas uses the same quote.
Sorry, Adi, can you just tell us which excerpt from the Quran it is? I'm curious.
I don't remember exactly. I remember like the quote itself. It's their time is in the morning. Isn't the morning getting closer? Now, the student, he is a secular student. He studies architecture. He saw the beauty of the words in the quote itself. And what he meant as a person is that we have to wait till the morning. We are living in uncertainty. Let's wait till the morning and we see maybe the light. So the morning for him represents the light or represents something that is very different from the dark times of the 7th of October. And this institution, they come and say, no, you didn't mean that. What you meant actually is that you are supporting the 7th of October. You are supporting the attack itself. He was accused and eventually he was found guilty of supporting Hamas and supporting terrorism. This case resembles the shift from criminalizing speech to criminalizing thought or to criminalizing rationale that you have for what you are posting or for what you are expressing either on social media or any other place. And it's the first time that quote from the Quran is criminalized for, and only the quote itself with nothing added to it. This is like an example maybe to give, but I'll move to numbers and then maybe move to different subjects. And so, as I mentioned, we are talking about 150, 160 students in 35 academic institutions. So we're talking something that's happening all over the country. And Adala is representing in around 100 cases. We manage generally to help students almost in half of the cases to return to their studies. But at the same time, where a punishment was decided, universities preferred a punishment of suspension of studies and to kick the students outside of the university. And it also resembles how the universities perceive this act itself. It's while universities and colleges usually prefer disciplinary measures or educational measures, especially when we're talking about free speech. Here, we see that the main measures are, you are not part of us. You have to leave this institution.
Just last week, to give you an example from Israel. So with a Jewish lecturer in a college, Regev Natanzon, he signs a petition of Academics for Peace. The petition is a letter to Biden asking Biden to stop trading weapons or selling weapons to Israel or sending weapons to Israel. A right-wing organization goes over all the names of whoever signed these petitions, this one and others. The organization is called Im Tirtzu. And then it looks for students on campuses. It gives the students the names of the professors who signed the petition on the campuses and asks the students begin a campaign in the campus against the lecturer. So last week there was two people, one from Open University and one from Sapir College. They demand that these professors be fired. There's this crazy, really horrendous speech acts of hate against them. He supports terrorism and so forth. So people start writing on the Instagram of the college, he supports terrorism, he should go to Gaza and so forth. The college administrator puts a like on claims that this professor supports terrorism. And then, so he says, I feel unsafe to go to campus. Now, he feels unsafe because we have to remember that, for example, in a different college in around October, November, Palestinians were in the dorms and a mob of Israeli Jewish people came to the dorms and started screaming death to the Arabs. Okay. And the students had to flee and the college helped them flee. That's how the college protected them, by helping them flee and go back to their homes. So this Regev Natanzon writes to the president and provost and says, listen, I feel unsafe to come to campus and I want to leave he doesn't say how much time, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I don't feel safe coming to campus in this atmosphere. And it was top of the news hour on the general television. It was in the newspapers. It was a major ordeal just last week. Anyway, they write him back and they say, okay, you can take an unpaid leave of absence for half a year. So he's being punished, half a year pay, because he signed a petition and they're protecting his freedom of speech. That's the atmosphere. And this is a Jew. If it was a Palestinian, it would have been much worse.
Adi, when you were speaking, the phrase that was resounding in my mind over and over again was a Walter Benjamin's aphorism that the tradition of the oppressed teaches us that for the oppressed, the state of exception is not the exception, but is in fact the rule. And all of these bizarre inversions that we see wherein calls for nonviolence then become construed as calls for violence because of the inherently, quote unquote, terroristic nature of the quote-unquote enemy. When you're speaking about that Quran verse being deemed a terroristic verse, it reminded me of cases in the US too, where even words like Arabic words like salam, which literally means peace, have been represented as terrorist code words in US terrorism prosecutions. Other bizarre inversions, for example, the idea that it's Israeli existence that is under threat is then used to solidify and advance a situation where it's Palestinian existence that is being wiped out. Or representations of universities as multicultural spaces and committed to anti-racism is used as justification for the punishment and eradication of Palestinian life from these spaces. These types of inversions have been so institutionalized and normalized through a counterterrorism discourse, which itself is the continuation of a long history of colonial practices, marking those on the end of colonial practices of genocide and eradication as themselves the sources of violence that need to be eliminated. Niamh, you spoke about the differences between UK and US universities, but one similarity that we've seen in these contexts is the deep investment of the university in practices of counterterrorism. In UK universities, there's the involvement of universities in prevent policing based on ideas of extremism and counter-radicalization that we know are deeply rooted in genealogies of Israel's suppression of Palestinian resistance, which was then globalized through the war on terror and which is now being deployed yet again full circle to suppress solidarity with Palestinians against genocide. In the US as well, apparatuses of counterterrorism and broader racial institutions of carceral terror are also being used to suppress students and professors in solidarity with Palestine. And so perhaps we can now turn our conversation to broaden the scope a little to think about the wider ecologies of domination, and particularly counterterrorism apparatuses in which universities are acting in consort in the project of repression of Palestine solidarity.
Could I say something related to that? I think one of the things that makes this moment so difficult for people who are part of the Palestine solidarity community is precisely because it comes, as we've already seen for a number of years now, this assault against what the right calls wokeness, which includes Black Lives Matter, assaults against or criticisms of critical race theory, LGBTQ rights, and DEI programming, which of course has become the stalking horse for these, for all of these critiques. And so that support for Palestinians has been constructed by some as part of this larger wokeism that they need to, and I think of these hearings that were held in which Elise Stefanik played the starring role in the fall were a clear indication of the merging of these two trends, right? She puts herself out as somebody who's fighting anti-Semitism through the calling out these university presidents who were purportedly incapable of condemning anti-Semitism. When in fact she represents a party that is, it has as a central part of its key base, white nationalists who are themselves anti-Semites, many of them at least. In addition to that, when we've had Zionists have long tried to delegitimize any attempts to equate or draw parallels between Israeli policies towards Palestinians and settler colonialism, and there's been this rejection of this framework entirely. And now, as these broader coalitions have been forming on campuses, and that is one really interesting development. It's not that there haven't been elements of solidarity in the past, but I, in my lifetime on a university campus, not that USC is a particularly politicized one, but just looking at what's been happening elsewhere, this seems to me to be a unique moment in terms of the kinds of solidarity across various activist groups, whether it's various ethnic groups, we were talking about Black Lives Matter, Black Student Alliances, Hispanic groups, Chicano groups, labor organizers, all of these groups seem to be coming together and working together, trying to strategize and be in solidarity with the Palestine Solidarity Committee at this time. And so with this broader solidarity developing, and then I think particularly when South Africa brought the genocide case to the ICJ, there has been an increased attempt by the pro-Israel activists to take on the settler colonial framework frontally and try and discredit it in a variety of ways, either arguing that how can Jews in Israel be settlers when in fact Jews have been living there for thousands of years, or just trying to describing settler colonialism as a framework that's Marxist and therefore it's automatically illegitimate. In fact, that particular phrase, I think, was used in some of the hearings that have been held by the same committee that grilled the university presidents. They played a particularly, I think, pernicious role, and they're continuing to hold hearings. I think the Columbia University president is going to be up next, and I think that also explains one of the reasons why she, in the last couple of weeks, has been just draconian in the way that she's had the university come down on a couple of events, which perhaps we can talk about later. But let me also just mention a couple of other elements that I think make this such a perilous time for activists on the issue of Palestine. I don't think we've ever seen the U.S.-Israel relationship, of course, is longstanding and it's deep and broad and so on. But I don't think we have ever seen in the past an administration so completely, fully, and unreservedly, unconditionally throw in its support behind not just a short-term war, but a war which has increasingly demonstrated its genocidal aspects. And had the Biden administration and the clear instruments and levers of power so strongly and forcefully behind what's happening, just creates a broader, it adds to the broader context or the broader environment of a sense of anti-Palestinian-ness. And I think if what the Biden administration is engaging in is not anti-Palestinian racism, I don't know what is. And I think we need to call it that. We have to stop using Islamophobia, although Islamophobia does exist, but we need to really continue to name and call out and make clear that what is happening is in large part an anti-Palestinian assault. And unless we call it that, then we continue to marginalize, we continue to diminish the the extent of what it is we're witnessing. So that's all part of this framework. So when students go to demonstrate, or when professors try and introduce new courses and have them slapped down, that's also happened in the US, where we've had cases where deans have intervened in syllabi in course readings. When this happens, it's against the background of what's already a heavily stacked situation, or an extremely unlevel playing field. So even if a university were to attempt to treat the two sides equally, it can't be equal because of the structural factors which have made it so oppressive and so constrictive up to date.
I'd like to come in particularly with what Laurie said in the beginning, because we have, in a way, an unprecedented moment. On the one hand, the Palestinians have managed to globalize their struggle. Civil society, from Indonesia to Los Angeles and from San Francisco to UK, is with the Palestinians. They understand that there's a moral issue here that is extremely problematic, and every single day for the past half year, there's probably been every single day hundreds of protests, hundreds of activities across the globe that support the Palestinian cause. At the same time, the ruling elites, the political elites, are still stuck in the same paradigms they've been stuck for years, okay? And so they are trying to shut us down, both in the universities and outside. And their two major tools are the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, okay, which conflates criticism of Israel and anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and, as you, Aziza, said, anti-terror law, which in the UK manifests itself as prevent. Okay? And they've been using these two tools against a civil society uprising, you could even say, against the political elites. And they've been clamping down like never before, putting people in jail, like we've seen the numbers already, we've discussed the numbers, and these numbers are supposed to create, they're supposed to be the examples that create the chill effect. We haven't mentioned the chill effect. The whole idea is to chill these protests, what one of the ministers here in the UK called protests of hate, they call us. We are protests of love, but they call us protests of hate. And so this is the moment we're in, and I think it's very much directed against the Palestinians and pro-Palestinians, and it's about the mobilization of these two factors in order to just silence everybody. And our role, I think, is to continue. We have to continue pushing back, because we are winning this. In Gaza, you can't see that we're winning it, but in the streets of London, you can see it. And so we just have to continue, and we have to continue pushing back and pushing back.
I just want to say how strengthening and how important the mobilization that's happening worldwide, and it's absolutely unprecedented. We're talking about one of the longest wars that Palestinians have lived since the Nakba, but we're also talking about the largest mobilization for Palestinians and for Palestinian rights, and one of the largest mobilizations against war generally. And as Niamh mentioned, the amount of dissonance or the amount of differentiation between the public opinion and the elites and the politicians is so grave and so big that either in academic institutions, but also outside of them, that it's so not taken for granted what is going on and the amount of mobilization that is happening. And eventually, as Niamh mentioned, this has to continue. This has to continue going everywhere, mobilizing against the war, because eventually the amount of complicity around the world, either through selling weapons or for giving protection or votes in the United Nations and so on, demands lobbying and demands mobilization, which is much more than just support. It's also an act of not only opposing, but also acting in order to stop and to prevent the war. And eventually, I think the amount of how much the Israeli public in general, but also how much the institutions that exist here are so far from this reality. This is perceived as a threat to the state, as a threat to the war, as something that is anti-Semitic and so on, to the amount that nothing can strike inside the mainstream Israeli brain these days that would in any way understand any criticism of the war from this point of view. And despite the fact that we're talking about an ICJ opinion that obliges the state to actually file criminal charges against people who are inciting for genocide and for who are inciting for deliberate killing of Palestinians. And as I've mentioned, also in academia, but also outside of academia, we're witnessing almost zero cases of people who are facing anything, any kind of procedure for incitement to violence or incitement to genocide. And for example, like in the student cases, we're talking about 90 of cases against Palestinian students, 2 cases against Jewish Israelis. One of them is a person who is actually charged with posts concerning the 7th of October. And the other student is charged for inciting against his own university because they are not filing charges against Palestinian students. There has been 0 cases of Israeli students who are actively inciting each and every day. We file complaints and other institutions have filed complaints against that. And despite the fact that academic institutions, as Aziza mentioned, they also describe themselves as multicultural, as the microcosmos of society, as including everyone and against racism in any kind of way, they are copying the policy of the state. And therefore, in this understanding, academic institutions are the structural racial discrimination or the system of apartheid from the state itself into the self-claimed or the self-entitled enforcement against free speech. I think just how far the Israeli media and the public is from the public opinion that's going around the world is best described in a way where free speech has been limited to war speech, in a sense. If you watch TV, if you go around social media, anything that goes outside the borders of we are in a war, we have to win, is seen and perceived as something that is going against the state itself, even when you're talking or criticizing certain policies or cases that are very concerning for the Israeli public, such as the hostages and so on. And I think that the general public or the public opinion is reflected in the war eventually, but it's also reflected in how much, honestly, insanity is seen in this war and how much the lack of ability to understand the reality outside of this manifestation of trauma. What we're seeing eventually in these last 6 months is manifesting trauma in order to commit a genocide against a whole nation, against the Palestinian people.
Right.
And therefore, the ability of Israelis to understand what is being talked about in these protests in the UK, in the US, and in Europe, and Latin America, and so on, is nothing but anti-Semitism in the idea of everything right now against the war is against our own existence.
Adi, you spoke about the crime of being Palestinian, and Niamh spoke about the crime of being sympathetic with Palestinians. I wanted to turn to Lori and the Mesa statement, because there you touch upon the crime of Palestinian life, the whole cultural sphere and the embeddedness of life in a particular set of histories, cultures, and practices. And I thought the Mesa statement was really commendable about how you went from very specific cases to a very broad connection to, between genocide and cultural genocide. Could you talk a little bit about the Mesa statement?
Sure. It was work that came from CAF as well as from the Mesa president and the board, all coming together in support of this kind of a strong statement about cultural genocide. Obviously, being on the Committee on Academic Freedom, all of us have been following very closely what's happened in universities and in Gaza, along with, of course, the terrible human loss. And at one point, I think it was when the central archives in Gaza City were bombed and destroyed, I was about to give a presentation somewhere, and that was another kick in the gut, as if we need, and these come every day, multiple waves. And it seemed to me that it was important that we start thinking a bit more broadly, not just about the loss of academic institutions, the universities and the schools, which in itself, again, terrible losses, but a much, just thinking much more broadly about what, and not just what sort of sources scholars might use, because initially I was thinking, this is terrible. This is a huge part of Gaza's history, which we'll never be able to know because those resources will never be available to scholars or to anyone who would want to examine them. Now, clearly there are element there. This is not this kind of destruction or in some cases appropriation of Palestinian historical or cultural institutions or elements. This is not new. We can look back to 1948 with the various personal libraries and other libraries that were looted and which became part of Israeli libraries and archives, much of which is not available to Palestinians. So this is not new. We saw what happened in 1982 with the invasion of Lebanon and the theft of the contents of the PLO Research Center. So again, there's a history to this. And I think it's important that when we look at what's happening now in Gaza, we keep that larger history in mind. And of course, there are many other examples that one could bring to bear. But in this case, it seemed important to think about sort of education and culture together, to the degree to which they construct who Palestinians are as a people, and how terribly important that is when people are under occupation, but particularly when they're facing a violence which is seeking to erase them entirely from their land. And to destroy them not only as physical human beings, but also to destroy all of the physical surroundings that gave meaning and shape to their history and to their lives, in which everything from archaeological sites dating back 4,000 years to more recent markets that gave Gaza and the various cities in Gaza or villages that surrounded Gaza, they're part of their identity, that the people were preserving, again, in some large museums, some of these very small museums in people's homes or in converted homes that were part museums and part libraries. All of this, which was part of this basic fabric of Gazan life and which has also just been systematically destroyed. And which part of the definition of genocide, if I recall correctly, which I believe we cited in the statement, has to do with the continuing possibility for life in a territory. And life isn't just, although God knows right now, the focus on human existence is primordial right now. But life also means these forms of attachments, these elements of everyday existence, as well as ties to this land, which has centuries, millennia of history of invaders and anyway, create and human just creativity and see all of that being systematically destroyed. Elements that brought communities together, small libraries, small public spaces that were used for various kinds of cultural events, literacy centers, small libraries, bookstores that were available to people who didn't have the opportunity to perhaps buy books themselves, but which were made available to increase literacy, increase interest in literacy, and be a point of contact for members of the community. All that being destroyed, it just seemed as though we as an organization that are committed to academic freedom, but not in a narrow sense, but in a much, much broader sense, that we had to say something. We've been writing letters for years defending colleagues in the West Bank, in Israel proper, in Gaza. And we continue to do so. We've continued to write letters which have tried to address the dreadful larger attacks on individuals and institutions, physical plant and so on, as this war has unfolded. But this seemed to be it just seemed that the situation cried out for a statement that would make connections that might not otherwise be made if people were just reading an individual letter about the destruction of universities, the destruction of schools, the arrest of student union leaders, and so on.
Can I just add one little thing?
Please.
We haven't, Laurie intimated this, but I think it's very important for our conversation to say that all the universities in the Gaza Strip have been bombed. Over 100 professors have been killed, and thousands of students have been killed. In addition, we have about half the schools in the Gaza Strip have been bombed, and one-third of them, we're talking 625,000 pupils, one-third of them will not open even when the war is open. So these students, children will not have a school to go back to, and they feed the universities. And so what we have is this destruction of higher education in the Gaza Strip that has been like eradicated. And yet I have not heard one president of a single university in the United States or in England coming out and saying, this is unacceptable. These are my colleagues. They're presidents of universities. You cannot destroy these universities. Not a single president has raised their voice to defend this total eradication of higher education in an area. And yet they are using anti-Semitism and terrorism to clamp down at who? At people that are against genocide, against violence, want a ceasefire, that are social justice. That is the moment we're in. And it's a crazy moment. It's simply a crazy moment in terms of what are these presidents thinking?
I think that just the absurd disparity in the logic is so stark and again speaks to the underlying colonial substrata of absurdity that underpins all of this. So on the one hand, we have universities and educational institutions in Gaza being rendered supposedly legitimate targets, according to Israel's interpretations of the laws of war, and bombed and attacked and turned into field execution sites with impunity. On the other hand, we have Israeli universities, which are actually part of the material infrastructure of settler colonization and violent military occupation, whether it be that they're situated on occupied Palestinian land, or they serve as sites for military training, or as part of this revolving door circulation system of experts from the military expertise complex to the university. These universities, which are materially implicated very deeply in the structure of occupation and colonization, it's acted as if these are spaces of innocence where it's impermissible to not only target them by bombs, but even through nonviolent measures like BDS. And so I'm wondering if this compels us to think more deeply about the institution of the university and its imbrication with settler colonization more generally. Lori, when you were speaking, it reminded me of Raphael Lemkin, who's credited with having coined the term genocide. For him, what distinguished genocide from simple mass killing was precisely the fact that it targeted the cultural life of a people as a people, their ability to exist as a coherent entity. And so it's not simply about physical destruction, but it's about epistemic destruction, cultural destruction, all of these things that target the ability of a people to function as a people, in which we know universities have been so complicit, from Palestine to Turtle Island, where I am in this land that currently calls itself Canada. Universities are not only built on colonized indigenous land, but are named after architects of genocidal institutions like residential schools, which were predicated on the erasure of indigenous knowledge as well as erasure of the lives of indigenous children. And so perhaps, and this is my last question, we could think more broadly about how this compels a rethinking of the idea of universities as institutions of not only innocence, but benevolence, such that adopting a position of neutrality or both sides is seen as a legitimate position, when that itself is premised on the obscuration of the university's deep involvement in systems of settler colonization transnationally.
Could I just insert one thing in response to what Niamh said? Because Niamh, you said it so beautifully that, and it goes back to something that Lori said about the back and forth that college presidents went through of making rather innocuous but okay statements of both sides, and then all of a sudden under this pressure from donors to say, it's all Hamas, we are appalled by that, and then saying, we're not going to make any more statements. So when all this terrible information that you cited about Scholasticide and more came out, I wrote to my president, who had flip-flopped, as everybody else did. I said, Richard, I understand you're not making any statements about politics. However, these are our colleagues. We can just look at it as parallel commitments to education and all these things. Surely you could say something about that. And he said, flatly, we're not making any more comments. So this is where, again, I am so appalled at the way in which this is silence, not just political statements, but any statement at all that recognizes the humanity of Palestinians. And I said, what other country, if this happened in any other country in the world, would you stay silent? And again, just nothing to say about this.
David, if I could say one thing with regard to your getting in touch with the university president, also, not only are these our colleagues, and absolutely, I think that it's criminal that there's been, I think Neva's right, I haven't seen any statements that have suggested that there's outrage, even grief about the loss of university colleagues. But beyond that, we're here in the United States in the belly of the genocidal beast. This is a country which is providing the weaponry. It's providing the political support, the economic support, and even in its upside down world way, the moral support for an ongoing genocide. So it seems to me, I understand that university presidents should be hesitant perhaps about, should we weigh in on all these political issues? But the fact that this is where we are seated, this is where we are living and from where we're working and where our taxes, what our taxes are going toward, it seems to me that also places this particular conflict area and this particular aspect of it, this episode of it, squarely in a range in which university presidents, if there's any moral leadership at all, and I think, you know, that ship, that train has left the station, just to get to Aziz's point, but if they're not going to make statements now, then when? And so if I could turn to what Aziza asked, it absolutely is a moment when we should be rethinking what universities do and their structures. And there are a lot of people who are doing that, but they're, it's also, we've been involved in a process of corporatization of the university in the United States and elsewhere for a number of decades now. So there are structural processes, there are economic processes, which have continued to gradually eat away at or to transform what the university used to be about and turn it into an institution which is basically producing knowledge primarily for corporate and other sort of economic interests, which also is interested in having faculty who are in a position of less power, meaning that we spend less on faculty, so we have more contingent faculty, which makes those faculty less secure and therefore often less willing to speak out, although there are many notable exceptions. And then we don't want to upset the donors because we're increasingly reliant on them. And so the combination is really quite toxic. And I don't know, faculty governance today does not mean, except perhaps in some rare exceptions, what it meant 20 years ago, where faculty actually had a voice, where there was input into university budgets in some cases, where faculty's opinions on issues of relevance to epistemology and so on actually counted for something with the university administrators. And so as we've gradually seen that power of faculty removed and transferred, often to people who have no academic training, by the way, you have these administrators who are brought in, they come out of some sort of technical training. As that increases and the emphasis is placed more and more on not educating students, but training them for jobs, we're at a situation, it's a really critical point. And I don't know if we're capable of bringing things back to where we were in an earlier era, or moving forward to a situation where universities actually play a more positive role in furthering critical examination and critical thinking and supporting strategies of greater liberation.
I can add two words and just say, in the UK, when I arrived here to the academia, it seemed to me that the UK university was this kind of amalgamation between imperial bureaucracy and what you touch on, I think, Aziza, is also when you say settler colonialism, which means a lot of things. It means displacement, replacement, elimination, but there's also a major racial component in it. And that is, I think, what we're seeing here at this moment, and this kind of neutrality that David was describing is a racist neutrality. It's deeply racist what is going on here. And I think we're seeing that everywhere. We're seeing it in Israel, where there's no shame. The racism is just out there in your face. And then we're seeing it in the academia in the United States and the UK and so forth. And your question is, what do we need to do? And everyone likes to say decolonize. And decolonize for the university, of course, means changing your syllabus and putting some people from the global south and people of color in your syllabus. And for us, of course, it means the democratization of power. Okay.
My last question, if it's okay, Aziza. On December 10th, 2013, the Washington Post ran this remarkable op-ed by Claire Finkelstein. To fight anti-Semitism on campus, we must restrict free speech. And so my question regards an article that came out in Ynet, and I'm not sure how reputable or believable this is, but it talks about Israel's strategy against anti-Semitism on U.S. campuses. Following the surge of incidents of hatred on campuses across the U.S., the Foreign Ministry, along with the Diaspora Affairs Ministry, will establish a task force on the agenda deeming anti-Semitic students ineligible for employment, outlawing anti-Semitic organizations. And this was followed up in Truthout. And this gets to some of the things we've been talking about, how U.S. institutions and probably other institutions in the world are becoming subcontractors for the Israeli state, right? That there's this convergence. And what Laurie mentioned, especially egregious in the United States, where we become basically informants on our own students for the purpose of furthering Israeli interest. Could you talk a little bit about, does this article resonate with you at all? Or do you find it predictable? Or how would you regard the, because the charge of anti-Semitism, as we've all said, has been so played to the hilt. But what happens when it actually takes on this very formal kind of agreement between the Israeli state and the U.S., for example?
So let me just begin by saying that I've had in the past half year several Israeli Jewish friends say they want to come to London, but they're afraid of the anti-Semitism, and they wanted to ask me if it's okay to come to London. And these are academics. These are not. And the propaganda works. They're afraid to come to London. It's much safer as a Jew in London than it is in Israel. We all know that. So they're afraid. And there's this whole thing because the IHRA is a shield. I write about human shields. It's a shield for Israel, right? It is out there as a shield to shield Israel. And it has had great success, great institutional success. 45 governments have adopted it. We have 75% of universities have adopted. 30 states in the United States have adopted it. It's everywhere. And there's different reasons for this kind of acceptance of the IHRA definition and its use and so forth. But I think one of the attractions of the IHRA is that it defends an ethnocratic state or a settler colonial state or an apartheid state, right? Now, many of these government and politicians, in a different context, they also want to defend these kind of hierarchical relationships in their society. They want what the IHRA offers, and the IHRA offers them what I call a democratic apartheid. They're trying to change the meaning of apartheid. Of democracy. They're trying to change the meaning of democracy so that you can have a democratic regime that's also an apartheid, okay, or also a settler colonial. And that's the attraction. And then they can move it and change it to other definitions. So we know that there's an Armenian definition, and we know there's other things going on now. And that's the institutional that goes beyond the case study of Israel and is appealing to them. So I disagree with the two of you that a lot of these things are emanating with Israel and Israel is wagging the dog. I don't think so. I think there's a kind of mutual thing of elites that share these political ideologies. In one place it's Zionism, in another place it's something else. But there's a kind of shared, and the IHRA seems to them, hey, this tool that was developed by Israel, maybe we can develop it in a different context or something a bit different that can be useful, that again is about maintaining in Israel its Jewish supremacy. In another case, in the United States, it's white supremacy. So something of that sort.
In a place like Canada, it also solidifies this idea of a multicultural, anti-racist settler colonial state, which is why it's so appealing to the Canadian government, because it dissociates conversations about anti-racism from material analyses of the structure of settler colonization that the state is built upon. And so then you get an analysis of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism as competing phenomenon that are both disconnected from the material basis of racism that emanates from the settler colonial foundations of the state.
I think in the case of the U.S., I agree completely with Nee, this IHRA definition is, that's the battleground. And we've been trying through various, some of our CAF letters, when state governments or educational institutions have decided or are discussing whether to adopt it, we've always weighed in and expressed why this is problematic. But I think in the U.S., what I would add is that because of the, and it, part of it is this talking about this white nationalism or this kind of racism, because of the large coincidence, I would say, between white nationalism and a certain kind of Christian, I mean, unquote from my perspective, but anyway, Christian nationalism, which has both a strong support for the state of Israel, but also anti-Semitism as part of its tenets, that you can adopt the IHRA, and therefore you can go after people who are against or speaking out against the state of Israel on campuses. And that sort of then hides your real anti-Semitism, if I can refer to it that way. And so you have lots of U.S. politicians who are on the right wing of the spectrum. Of course, we can talk about the center or the pseudo left wing of the spectrum in other terms. But there's a real sort of enthusiasm among Republican governors and Republican state houses and legislators to adopt this, because it dovetails nicely with their sort of pro-Israel sentiments, which then hide an anti-Semitism, which is insidious. And so I just think that needs to be highlighted when we think about what the IHRA does, what work it's doing in terms of the domestic politics of the United States, which in some ways had very little to do specifically with Israel.
Thank you all so much for being here. It's wonderful. I know you're all busy, but I think we had a really thorough discussion, and we wish you the best. And do let us know, Adi, how we can help you in any way. Okay.